Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. It's a story as old as time. A man and a woman who are committed to other people find themselves in a secret affair. In modern days, they leave their homes and their partners behind to drive off in a car under the cover of night to a seedy motel somewhere they can be alone. They meet up in secret and share their secret only with their closest friends, if anyone at all. But what happens when those lovers leave their homes and never return? Of all of the stories I have covered that involve a secret affair, this is definitely one of the most gruesome. It is also one of the most mysterious. This story includes a serial killer, a message scrawled on a mirror with a bar of soap, and a gory, bloody double axe murder that left two people dead, two others without their partners, and two children without their parent. This is the story of the Amana Axe Murders. I'm your host, Stacy Lee. Let's get into it. Two people drive towards a motel in Amana, Iowa. Both of them are keeping a very big secret. This is Roger Atkison. Roger was a 32-year-old GTE employee who worked on and installed lines for the phone company. Roger was married to this woman, Marcy Atkison, and they lived in St. Joseph, Missouri. Roger was a religious man. He attended King Hill Baptist Church, and he even sang in the church choir. He was also in charge of maintenance on the church bus and often drove it on outings. Everyone who knew Roger says he was polite, he was pleasant, and he was a straight arrow. He wasn't involved in drugs or anything illegal. He was a very average man who lived a very average life, as far as they knew. But Roger was restless. He had grown unhappy in his marriage to Marcy. When he turned 30, he started feeling older, and he realized his life wasn't quite turning out the way he'd hoped and dreamed that it would. He had been in the military, and that was far more exciting than being a telephone line repairman, and he just was feeling like he was at a place in his life where he was wanting more. One day, Roger was out on his usual route, going through his daily list of repairs to attend to. He rang the doorbell at his next stop, and this woman answered the door. She was 22-year-old Rose Burkert, and there was an instant spark between Roger and Rose. Rose was a decade younger than Roger, and she had a young daughter named Rachel. Rose was working as a nurse at Methodist Hospital there in St. Joseph at the time, and she was instantly attracted to Roger. Rose was quiet, and she was a homebody. Her friends later said it was difficult for them to even get her to go to a show or go out for a night of dancing. She would rarely even see a movie. When she wasn't working, Rose stayed at home with her daughter. Of course, no one knows the details of how the relationship progressed, but before long, Roger and Rose were having a full-blown affair. Rose told some of her girlfriends about Roger, and although they disapproved, they wanted to hear all of the details of the romantic encounters, and what made the whole thing even more interesting was that Rose was such an introvert. She wasn't at all the type of person to go out and get involved in a sexual romantic relationship with a married man, so it was shocking to those who knew her. Roger and Rose were very, very worried about being caught. Roger, of course, didn't want his wife to find out about the affair, and Rose didn't want anyone she was acquainted with to know she was seeing a married man. The whole thing was very taboo and very salacious in the conservative religious area of St. Joseph. But sometimes these attractions are just too strong to resist, and Roger and Rose found themselves trying to spend time together whenever possible. On the night of September 12th, 1980, they had a very special meetup planned. Roger and Rose decided they were going to sneak away and go out of town together. First, they met in another town. We're going to talk about that in a second. And then they drove about 300 miles to Amana, Iowa to be together. Now, 300 miles is a long way to go for a night in a cheap motel. The fact that they drove that far away is really telling, isn't it? They did not want there to be any chance at all that someone they might know would see them together. They were taking all kinds of precautions, and that was the reason they chose to go so far away to spend the entire night together. Roger and Rose pulled into this motel, the Holiday Inn Amana. This is how it looked back at the time of the events that we're talking about today. This is a very typical hotel for the late 1970s, early 1980s. Attached to the hotel is a coffee shop, a diner called the Seven Villages Restaurant. The interior of the rooms looked something like this, and the pool looked like this back then. These kinds of images make me want to take a time machine right back to a simpler era. I love the vintage look of the hotel, the 1970s style decor, and the indoor pool. Roger and Rose, however, weren't interested in the restaurant or the swimming pool. They were there for the motel room. They checked into the hotel room around 7 o'clock that evening, and they were given room 260, the last room at the end of a long hallway. They only paid for one night and told the clerk that they would be leaving the following morning. Checkout time came and went, and neither Roger nor Rose appeared at the front desk to return their room key and settle their bill. So as is customary, the front desk clerk called the room, and there was no answer on the phone. The manager then asked a member of the housekeeping staff to go and check on the couple and let them know it was time to check out or they would have to pay for another night's stay. As the housekeeper approached the door of room 260, she could hear that either the TV or the radio was on in the room. She knocked and got no answer. She waited for about 20 seconds and then knocked again, this time a bit louder. Again, she got no reply. At that time, she went to the lobby and informed the front office manager, Dean Morse, that she wasn't getting any type of response from the couple in room 260, and she had kind of a strange feeling. Dean and the housekeeper then walked down the long hallway together, and when they got to room 260, Dean knocked loudly on the door. Just like the housekeeper, he got no reply. He knocked again, same thing. He then took the master hotel room key from his pocket and opened the door to the room, expecting to see the couple sleeping inside. That is not at all what he saw. As he peered into the motel room, he immediately knew something was terribly wrong, but he couldn't quite process what he was seeing. The room wasn't well lit, and so he took a step or two towards the inside of the room. He could see that both Roger and Rose were lying face down on the bed, but they weren't sleeping. They were covered in blood, soaked in blood, and they were not moving. Dean froze for a few seconds and then backed out of the room. He turned to the housekeeper and told her to stay out of the room, and then he ran down the hall to his office and called the police. I'll bet you, for hotel workers, this is something from time to time they think about. Wouldn't you imagine? Have any of you ever worked in a motel? I would think it would go through your mind once in a while that, gosh, you know, I might open a room door and find something awful. When the first officers to arrive met with Dean, he appeared to be in shock. He was telling the police that this might be all some elaborate and very distasteful prank. He was actually wondering if he should have even called the police before looking a little closer, and he was starting to feel as though he might be the butt of someone's very bad joke. Sadly, that was not the case. The officers walked down the long hallway to room 260 and went inside. They knew almost immediately Roger and Rose were dead, and the hotel and room 260 were now a crime scene. The officers knew very early on that this couple had not been shot. There was way too much blood for that. A gunshot leaves very little blood on top of the body. The blood pools under the body. Well, Roger and Rose were covered with blood on top of their bodies, and the bed and surrounding carpet was soaked. There was so much blood at the crime scene that detectives were initially unable to determine what type of injuries Roger and Rose had. There were thick pools of blood on the bed, and there were splatters all over the walls, the ceiling, and especially the headboard. They found it odd that Rose was fully clothed. The couple were laying in bed. Why was she dressed? Roger, on the other hand, was wearing only his boxer shorts. The crime scene was roped off and the bodies were removed after photographs were taken. This is the only photograph that has ever been released. It is simply the open door going into room 260, and you can see a little bit of what the interior looks like. Roger and Rose were taken to the medical examiner, where it was ruled that the cause of death was brain injuries and loss of blood. From what? From an axe. Each of the victims had been struck repeatedly in the head with a small, short-handled axe or a hatchet. The majority of the wounds were to the skull, but several of Roger's fingers had been chopped clean off as he held up his hand in front of his face in an instinctual gesture to protect himself from the blows. As he held his hands up in a futile attempt to protect himself, he lost his fingers and part of his right hand. Detectives went about the gruesome task of carefully processing the crime scene in hopes that they would be able to find some type of clue as to who had committed the terrible crime. One of the first things they noticed is that the hotel room showed no signs of forced entry, and to them, this was an indication that either Roger or Rose may have known the attacker. Whoever committed the double murder hadn't had to break into the room. They had to be let in. Now, that could also be explained away easily by assuming someone knocked, posing as maintenance or housekeeping or room service. But whatever the case, the door had not been forced open and the lock was not damaged. The door frame was not damaged. But the other thing that made officers believe Roger and Rose may have known their attacker is that both of the chairs in the hotel room had been pulled away from the little table, you know, that sits in the corner of the hotel room. And one of those chairs had been placed at an angle towards the bed as if someone had pulled it up and sat in the chair while they were talking to the couple who were in bed. The police began to wonder, was this someone that Roger was so familiar with that he didn't feel the need to get dressed? Had Rose been undressed, and when a knock was heard at the door, she hurriedly threw her clothes back on? There was something else. Someone, police assumed the attacker, picked up a bar of soap and began carving it with a knife. Then the soap was taken and used to write a message on the bathroom mirror. But after the message was written, the writer took the soap and scribbled the majority of the message out. The only word that was still legible was one word. It said, "This." That was it, the word "this." The rest of it had been scribbled to the point that they couldn't tell what it had originally said. What did this mean? The little bits of soap around the bed, all around the bed, in fact, made the police believe that the killer had sat and carved the soap after killing the couple and had even, like, walked around the bed carving the soap with a knife. So that's freaky. Below the message on the mirror, in the bathroom sink, blood and toothpaste were smeared all over the basin. As they continued to look around, police realized that toothpaste was also intentionally smeared all over the bottom of the bathtub. They couldn't figure this out. Was it just an attempt to clean up or maybe get rid of fingerprints, or was it just a random act of more madness, just someone making a mess? Now, we know that killers, serial killers especially, fall into two categories, organized and disorganized. There are, of course, also crimes of opportunity and crimes of passion, but the smeared blood and the toothpaste were strange to the investigating officers. Why would anyone take the time to make the mess in the sink and the bathtub? The killer had obviously brought his own weapon with him, and he had taken it as well. There wasn't an axe in the room. He brought it. That seemed to indicate that the crime was planned, and that seemed to indicate that the killer was more organized. The mess in the sink and the bathtub, however, seemed kind of disorganized. After the crime scene was processed and the crime scene cleanup unit began to strip the room of everything that had been soaked in blood, detectives began to interview the family members and the friends of the victims. Roger's friends and family were stunned. They could not believe that this mild-mannered telephone repairman had been found chopped up with an axe in bed with a woman who was not his wife. It was completely out of character for what they knew of Roger. But we all have our secrets, don't we? The more police spoke with people who knew Roger and Rose, the more discouraged they became. Obviously, the first possible motive to look into was jealousy. Roger was married and Rose had some ex-boyfriends. Could one of those people be responsible for this grisly attack? Police were able to quickly rule out robbery. The hotel room had not been ransacked. The drawers were in place. The couple's belongings hadn't been rifled through. In fact, Rose's purse was sitting right where she had put it down, and it had her wallet inside, containing cash, credit cards, and several traveler's checks worth quite a bit of money, thousands of dollars. She was also still wearing all of her jewelry, and there was more jewelry in her purse. As police showed Rose's belongings to her family and friends, they did notice one thing was missing. Rose usually kept a small black address book in her purse. She had important phone numbers and addresses written down in that little black book, and it was gone. This was discouraging to the police because that book contained the names of people that might be suspects that may need to be investigated. But it was also discouraging because no one could say for sure whether or not Rose even had the book with her when she left for Iowa. Here is a diagram of how police found the room. Roger and Rose are face down in bed. You can see the chairs, one at an angle, and there are soap bits around the bed. There are suitcases on the opposite side of the bed, and Rose's purse is at the foot of the bed. In the bathroom are two towels thrown about, and the diagram indicates the writing on the mirror and the blood and toothpaste in the sink in the bathtub. Just exactly who were the police dealing with here? A calculated assassin or an out-of-control maniac? September 14th, 1980. The long investigation begins. Detectives continue to investigate for days and then weeks following the double murder. All of the employees at the Holiday Inn were interviewed, and the police were successful in tracking down almost all of the other guests that had been in the hotel on the night of the murders. There had been a convention of funeral home directors in Amana, Iowa on the night of the killings, and so the hotel was at full capacity. The only reason that Roger and Rose were able to get a room is because there had been a cancellation. So that is an entirely new angle to the killings. What if Roger and Rose had stayed somewhere else? Would it have been the people who originally booked the room and then canceled that would have been murdered? Or was it a targeted attack against Roger and Rose? Imagine being the person or people that had booked that hotel room and then canceled. Like, you would be living the rest of your life like every day was the best day of your life, wouldn't you? I would be. It's too bad that sometimes something scary has to happen to us in order for us to realize like every day is precious and we should enjoy every one, you know? One of the things I find most surprising about this story is not only is it an axe murder, it's a double axe murder. And not only that, it occurred in a hotel room, a hotel that was booked to capacity, meaning that there were people staying in the rooms across the hall and that the room that shared a wall with room 260, you know, they're just right on the other side of the sheetrock. Explain to me how on earth no one heard anything. But they didn't. The police asked. They spoke to the guests all around room 260 and not one of them heard anything unusual. We don't know exactly what time of night the murders took place, but there is an estimate. We'll talk about that in a second. We do know a couple of things. One, the door was not broken into. It was opened. So that would have been quiet. Two, if the person who entered the room was not someone Roger or Rose knew, wouldn't there have been shouting as soon as they discovered a stranger or even a hotel worker? Three, two people were killed at the same time with an axe. How do you do that? You can hit one of the people on the head hard enough for them to maybe be incapacitated, but then the second person is going to start screaming. How did the killer kill both of the people in total silence with an axe? Four, we know that the killer is going to be completely covered in blood. We know that there was blood on the walls, the floor, the ceilings, and the headboard. So that means that every time the killer brought the axe up, blood was splattering everywhere. He had to have been covered in blood. How did anyone get out of the hotel room without somebody noticing they were covered in blood? I mean, we've seen Dexter. We've seen, you know, the blood splatter that happens when you bring back a weapon that's covered in blood. There's blood everywhere. When the police spoke to Marcy, Roger's wife, she was adamant. She had absolutely no idea that Roger had been having an affair. She seemed genuinely shocked to hear that her husband had been found in bed with another woman, that he had been killed in that very bed. Marcy said she also had no idea who Rose was. She had never seen her before and had definitely never met her. Now, Marcy was the person who ended up letting the police in on just how Roger explained this overnight trip. Roger told his wife that he was scheduled to travel to Cahokia, Missouri for work. He told her he would spend the week there installing phone lines, that he would work Monday through Friday, and then he was also scheduled to work there the following week in the same town. So he told Marcy that instead of driving the 4 hours home to St. Joseph between the weeks, he was just going to stay in Cahokia for the weekend. Marcy had no idea that her husband was actually meeting his mistress. When the police first told Marcy about her husband's murder, she insisted that they had to be mistaken. She said her husband was not in Amana, Iowa. He was in Cahokia, Missouri. When the officers told her that they'd found Roger's ID on him, Marcy said someone must have stolen it. She was very, very hesitant to believe the officers, and it took her quite some time before it fully sunk in. Her husband had been having an affair, and her husband was dead. Now, Roger had spoken with some of his friends about his marriage. Several of Roger's friends knew that Roger was unhappy in his marriage and that he wanted a divorce. Roger had even shared with some coworkers that he told Marcy he was going to divorce her, and Marcy said she would refuse to grant Roger a divorce. This is what Roger told his friends. So these friends knew about the unhappy marriage, and they also knew about Rose. Like I said earlier, Rose had friends that knew of the affair. So we've got people that knew Roger and people that knew Rose that both knew about the affair. One of Rose's friends who knew about the affair had even agreed to watch Rose's daughter, Rachel, while she was away with Roger. So while Roger was in Cahokia working, Rose dropped her daughter off at a friend's house on the Wednesday before the murders. Rose then drove to Cahokia and checked into a motel there. When she registered as Rose Atkinson and told the clerk that she was Roger's wife. When Roger finished working in Cahokia for the week, he and Rose got into Roger's car and made the 2-hour drive from Missouri to Amana, Iowa. And that is where they registered under the names Mr. and Mrs. Roger Burkert. They used Rose's last name at the Holiday Inn where they were murdered. Police found out that just after checking in on Friday, Rose called the friend who was watching her daughter to check in and make sure everything was okay. Roger and Rose then called room service and ordered dinner, which they ate in their room. This is where the time frame of the murders comes from that I spoke of earlier. The best time frame of the murders came from that room service meal. The coroner believes, by the amount of digestion that had taken place after the food was delivered, that the couple was killed around midnight. They know what time the food was delivered. Everybody eats when the food comes. And so there had been some digestion that had taken place. The coroner said he thought they were murdered around midnight. In the first few weeks of the investigation, this double axe murder was all anyone was talking about. The police interviewed more than 400 people in the first few weeks following the murders, but the trail was getting colder by the day. The residents of Amana were, of course, horrified. This was a little town in Iowa that had very little violent crime, and now the people in the area had to wonder if there was a maniac running loose in their city. As the police became more and more desperate, they began to release a little more information in hopes that it might jog someone's memory and give them some more clues. They told the public that Roger and Rose had been in Cahokia before going to Amana. They spoke with the employees at the Cahokia Hotel, and they spoke with other guests at that hotel, and nobody knew anything. They didn't claim they had seen anything strange. Some of them remembered seeing Roger and Rose there, but nothing unusual happened. 2 weeks after the murders, Marcy's parents, those would be Roger's in-laws, offered a $1,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest of the killer. A few tips came in here and there, but none of them panned out. Let's talk about the ex-boyfriend. Rose had broken up with an ex-boyfriend after she found out he was using drugs in her house. She had told friends and coworkers that this ex had been stalking her. He would call her house and leave notes on her car and was just generally a nuisance who wouldn't go away. Rose got so frightened at one point that she called the St. Joseph Police Department and told them she was being harassed. Rose actually said to the police officer taking the report, "If I am ever found dead, he will be to blame," meaning her ex. So, of course, the police called this ex-boyfriend in for questioning, and he had an ironclad alibi. That alibi was never publicly released, but police say there was no possible way Rose's ex could have committed the Amana murders. He couldn't have been in Amana at the time. The ex-boyfriend also passed a polygraph, but you know how I feel about those. We don't need to go into that whole song and dance. So that rules out the ex-boyfriend. Now we have to talk about the serial killer. Yes, there is a serial killer involved in this story. Some of the officers were completely convinced that Marcy's family knew about Roger's affair. Marcy may not have known, but they believed her family members did. Marcy had an uncle, and his name was Charles Hatcher. We have not covered Charles Hatcher on this channel yet, but we are going to. Charles Hatcher was a despicable man who committed vile and terrible crimes, some against children, and he was a close relative of Marcy's, like her uncle. So now police had to look into him as a possible suspect. Charles Hatcher had been in and out of not only jail, but mental institutions all throughout the 1970s. He was arrested on May 3rd, 1979 for assault and attempted murder when he tried to stab a 7-year-old. He was sent back to a mental health facility and released in May of 1980, so he was free at the time of this double murder. He was not locked up and his whereabouts were unknown at the time of the killing. Some of the investigating officers were convinced that Marcy or her family had gotten her uncle to commit the murders, but there was absolutely zero evidence to back up these theories. After thoroughly investigating Charles Hatcher, the police ruled him out. And by that time, most of them were convinced that Marcy was really telling the truth. She didn't know her husband was cheating on her, and she didn't know anything about the murders. A year went by, and there was almost no progress on the case. All of the interviews went nowhere, the leads dried up, and the case went cold. State authorities then brought in the FBI in hopes that they could find something that had so far been missed. At this time, profiling was in its infancy, so the FBI helped to create a criminal profile for the suspect. But with nothing to go on, it was simply filed away in hopes that it might one day be helpful. 2 years after the crime was committed, most people had forgotten about it. With each passing month, the Amana Axe murders was becoming a very cold case. December 1984. A detective who had worked the case from the beginning came forward and told reporters that he was 99% sure he knows who the killer is. He said the problem he has is that there is no solid evidence to back up his theory, but the suspect knew one of the victims. This detective will not say whether it was Rose or Roger that his suspect knew. This cop said the person he is talking about has been a suspect pretty much since day one. But early on, this person retained a lawyer and refused to speak to the police. The officer then said that unless something breaks wide open and changes drastically, there will be no way to prove this man is the killer. Decades went by, and then in 2009, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation formed a cold case unit, and this case was one of the first it was assigned to look at. All of the evidence was pulled out of storage, and detectives decided to look at it as though it was a brand new case. That turned out to be a very good idea because some new leads were uncovered. The detectives resubmitted every piece of evidence for retesting because, of course, testing is now light years ahead of where it was back in 1980. Both of the bathroom towels found tossed about in the motel room bathroom were retested. On one of the bathroom towels, technicians found DNA belonging to Rose, to Roger, and to an unknown male. This male could absolutely be the killer. The unknown DNA was submitted to the database, but there were no hits. Now, my friends, this case is a perfect example as to why I'm so passionate about raising money for cold case DNA testing. Of course, it's about solving the case the DNA was collected for, perhaps a murder or a robbery. But once that perpetrator's DNA is tested, not only could it close the main case it's associated with, it's forever in the system, which makes it more possible for future hits. That is the end goal on this channel. And that's why, if you can, I would love for you to join my Patreon. But anyway, it is now 2023, and this 43-year-old case is stone cold. In fact, most people had never even heard of this case until it was covered on a podcast not too long ago. Marcy is still alive and still looking to find out who killed her husband. I found a news clip where she talks about a book she is writing on the story.
In 1980, Roger Atkison and Rode Burkett were murdered in a hotel in Iowa. That case has remained unsolved for nearly 40 years, but Atkison's former wife, Marcella Schatt, is still hoping that the cold case can finally be solved. News Press Now's Jessica Edson met with Schatt to talk about her recent interview with a true crime podcast and the book that she's written.
I just kept thinking, he's going to call any minute to tell me that his ID was found on somebody else and he's okay, but never got the call, so.
It was nearly 40 years ago that Marcella Schatt lost her husband, Roger Atkison, when he was killed alongside his girlfriend, Rose Burkett, in a hotel in Iowa. Their gruesome murders have never been solved, and now the mysterious case has generated some buzz from the world of true crime podcasts. Schatt's retelling of the case will be featured on both Criminology and the Murder in My Family podcast that reach nearly 500,000 people.
We want to help see the case solved and maybe generate awareness to people who might not be familiar with it, maybe share the tip line information and stuff with people so they can provide information about the case.
Along with the two podcasts, Schatt is also writing a book to try to spark some interest in the case and hopefully solve the murder of her husband. Along with looking for answers, Schatt is also hoping that her book will provide some comfort to those in similar circumstances by showing how she overcame her hardships.
When he was first killed, I thought, if someone would just come to me and say, you're going to be okay. You know, I've been through this. It's going to be hard, but you'll make it through. And so that's one of my purposes, to inspire, and that people can see they can get through anything with God's help.
For News Press Now, I'm Jessica Edson.
There are a lot of morals to this story, but I'll save the judgment for someone else. No one deserves to be murdered for having an affair. No one deserves to be hacked to death for sneaking around. This is a tragic tale that left kids without parents and families without their loved ones. These are the stories of the monsters who live among us. These are the stories that remind us, watch out for what you do, for the decisions you make, and watch out who you open your door to. You never know. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you like the video, subscribe to the channel if you want to see more from me, and of course you can join my Patreon. You know what the end goal is there, and if you want to donate $1 a month, that helps. It helps to support the channel and it helps to reach our ultimate goal. I sure appreciate you being here. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.